This is the Music Publishing Podcast with your host, Dennis Tobenski. Join Dennis in his weekly nuts and bolts conversations with composers, performers, and other arts professionals as they navigate their careers as concert musicians in the 21st century. And now your host, Dennis Tobenski.
Hello, and welcome to the Music Publishing Podcast. I'm back this week with a repeat guest, who, despite the fact that we live together, can't manage to record an episode in the same room. So welcome back, Darian Shulman.
Thank you. It's very good to be here again.
Yeah. So last time you were on the show, we teased that you had a big project coming up that you were working on at the time. Now it's real. It's in the world. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
It's a Netflix series.
Yay!
It is a series called American Vandal, which I composed and produced the full score for. It's an 8-episode comedy satire. I had been working on that for pretty much all of spring.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of the end of winter and through the beginning of June.
Yeah. It was a pretty big project. I didn't see you much.
It was a very big project, and I was very much kind of stuck in my own world.
You sort of have to be with these sorts of projects, though. They're kind of all-consuming because they're so big.
Well, at least the first time. I mean, mm-hmm. I feel as though I didn't really know what to expect, so my sort of default position was assume that anything can happen at any time. So always... just always be ready, always be thinking about it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and always be writing a lot of music.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to stay ahead of the schedule.
Yeah, really.
As much as you possibly can.
this was a tight schedule for you. Well, for the project, and then ultimately for you is pretty tight.
The whole schedule was very tight. I'm amazed that we got such a good product at the end of it, because it was very quick.
Yeah.
It was a very quick turnaround.
Yeah. I couldn't believe, I mean, I don't have any experience in that area, but I couldn't believe how quickly everything was filmed and edited, and you know, how quickly you were able to turn around the whole score.
Right. Well, it helps to know the people that you're working with really well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And have a good sort of rapport with them.
Yeah.
So you know what each other, you speak each other's language, and you know what each other wants.
Mm-hmm.
And what each other's trying to do.
Yeah.
Going into it. I think that's part of the, that's a big reason why they wanted me on board.
Mm-hmm. So I guess, tell us how did you get this gig? You clearly have worked with these people a lot.
I've worked with Tony, Yacenda, and Dan Peralt over the course of the past almost decade now.
Mm-hmm.
A lot.
Yeah.
And we started when they were really just out of Emerson College, just out of school. And they had recently moved to Los Angeles. They're mm-hmm. both East Coasters
mm-hmm.
Originally. And they started to produce these digital shorts that they would release on YouTube and Vimeo, under the umbrella of this company that they created called Woodhead Entertainment,
mm-hmm.
which is after they're literally named after the football player Danny Woodhead. it has to do with one of the first digital shorts that they created.
Okay.
Which was that actually was not one I was involved in because there was no music in that. But that's how that name came about. Anyway, I had been working with them and sort of building a sort of really nice collaborative creative relationship with these guys. The shorts got, you know, the digital shorts, the projects got bigger and more ambitious.
Mm-hmm.
And they sort of kept me along for that. You know, in the meantime, I was sort of doing my own, stuff. I was doing the commercials,
mm-hmm.
Through all this, I was doing my teaching. Now when it came to American Vandal, I first heard about it from them, I would say around September or October of, 2016,
mm-hmm.
just after they had sold they had pitched it to, mm-hmm. A few different, networks.
Yeah.
And, Funny or Die was the first production company to really get on board with them, and they helped them, sort of develop, this thing into something. I think originally, I mean, from reading the interviews, they thought it would be a good idea, you know, for a kind of a sketch.
Mm-hmm.
This is really their background so far. I mean, yeah. I guess I should like backtrack. Like, for those of you who don't know,
yeah, I was just gonna say.
for those of you who don't know the premise of the show, right? Right now there's this huge. Huge trend of true crime going on,
mm-hmm.
in American, you know, entertainment. And so we have these shows that are kind of documentary style series, shows like Making a Murderer,
mm-hmm.
or The Jinx, mm-hmm. or Amanda Knox, and then we're not talking about TV. There are podcasts like Serial,
mm-hmm.
and other things. So it's these kind of true stories,
mm-hmm.
That are sort of told through the point of view of this one sort of or two kind of intrepid documentarians,
mm-hmm.
who are convinced that they don't have the whole story and want to bring the whole story to the viewer or the listener.
Mm.
And it's very addictive. People get very invested in it.
Oh yeah.
So American Vandal takes that idea. Usually these crimes that they are delving into are very, you know, kind of serious, gut-wrenching, horrible crimes, rapes, and murders.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of things that, you know, just completely destroy lives.
Yeah.
In American Vandal, it is a vandalism, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
you could probably tell that from the title of the show. The vandalism is ostensibly committed by a high school senior who's kind of a burnout idiot. There's a terrible reputation.
Mm-hmm.
Vandalism itself is 20 cartoon penises that have been spray painted on 27, I should say.
Yeah.
27 cartoon penises spray painted on 27 faculty cars,
mm-hmm.
at the high school where he goes to. He swears he didn't do it. Everyone thinks he did it. And this kind of documentary I say that in quotes, delves into, you know, whether or not this guy actually is innocent.
Yeah. The I always like the tagline for the show and the hashtag for it. Who drew the dicks?
Hashtag who drew the dicks. Yeah. I mean, a lot of the marketing for the show was, reliant on social media, and the show itself is very, you know, heavy on the sort of social media aspect.
Yeah.
Of this. So it's a really, I mean, the best reviews of the show have really kind of appreciated what a sort of accurate picture it is to actually be a high school student in the year 2000, the year 2016 or 17. So that's the premise of the show. Now, getting back to what I was saying before, I don't even remember where I was going before we did this diversion. We were talking about how I got the show.
Yeah, and the guys were working.
Woodhead, as Funny or Die was helping them develop, it seems to me that they became more and more ambitious.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought to themselves, no, we actually might have an actual series here instead of just a kind of one-off sketch. So by the time CBS and Netflix picked it up, they had conceived of a full season where almost the entire plot was pretty much set out for them. So that's when I first heard about it. Tony sent me an email, or he gave me a call. I can't really remember. And he said, we just sold this thing. We're all really excited. I don't know if I can hire you, but I want to hire you. I just want you to be aware that this is coming, that this is coming within the next few months or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was like, oh, that's great. You know, that's very exciting. Can't wait to it. And then sort of flash forward to December or January. At that point, they had finished the writing process. They were gearing up to start actually filming this thing. So they were casting and they were, you know, scouting locations and all of that. And he said, you know, he called me again. He said, let's write some demos.
Yeah.
Here's what I'm thinking. He threw out a bunch of references. A lot of the music in the this true crime series that I mentioned before.
Yeah.
They were sort of big influences on my music. He said, I want stuff like that. Yeah. I want stuff that evokes that without sounding too much of a parody.
Yeah, yeah.
So obviously do your, you know, put your own voice to it, but you know, think about what these other composers are trying to convey.
Yeah.
So I had spent like a week and a half watching all these true crime documentaries. Which you don't like, so I had to do.
I was like, you can do that on
my own. And so I wrote a few demos, and I think that once the demos were listened to on the other end, that's when some other people who really didn't know me, didn't know who I was and didn't know, like, you know, what I was able to do. They were like, oh, okay, he actually can compose. he's not just Tony and Dan's like buddy from back home. And, you know, at that point, it was pretty clear that I was getting the job. So while they were filming, we knew that it was going to be a very tight process.
Mm-hmm.
It was going to be a very tight schedule. And I think the original plan was going to be that they were just going to use music from their library.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Funny or Die has an extensive library of music that they can just kind of grab if they need it. Tony and Dan really wanted to make this series as kind of authentic as they could.
Yeah, it's hard to do that with like stock music.
Yeah. I mean, you can. It's just, you know, it's just hard.
Yeah, you've got more work to do.
You know, you need a very talented music editor, which they could have done.
Yeah,
I mean, they could have hired a music editor instead, and you know, they might have been able to get something.
Mm-hmm.
Good, but I'm glad they didn't. I'm glad they used me instead, obviously.
Yeah.
So we knew we had to stay ahead of schedule, so Tony sent me the whole series, the script, all eight episodes. So I knew how the series was gonna go.
Mm-hmm.
We talked sort of extensively about, you know, what scenes were going to be important, what kind of moods were going to be important, what kind of, you know, themes that we would want for different characters and stuff. And he said, okay, just start writing some music.
Mm-hmm.
I think the first thing we did was like write, kind of use, we said, he said like, let's use the script for episode one and create some sort of imaginary cues for these imaginary scenes that haven't been shot yet or that we're shooting, but you can't, you know, obviously you can't get access to them. So, you know, in addition to like the kind of one-off demos that I was doing, I was also starting to, you know, take material from that and, actually kind of, quote unquote score these scenes.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, they were very, I mean, obviously there's no picture, so there were no hit points. There was nothing to really time it to.
Yeah.
There were a couple of things that I knew were going to happen that, you know, where I would do like a strong kind of rhythmic downbeat or whatever. But, you know, obviously it was the kind of thing where I knew that they would, you know, listen to it. Maybe the editors would have it and just drop it in it as, you know, temp or whatever.
Yeah.
The process, the filming process was, it was 5 weeks.
Yeah. It was super fast.
That's 5 weeks for, you know, eight half-hour episodes.
Yeah, which is...
on average, a half hour.
Yeah, it's crazy. I couldn't believe they did that fast.
not only that, they did it that fast, they did it that well.
Yeah, they did.
You know?
It's... that acting is really good.
the cast is just a phenomenal cast.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much everybody on this show is... it's just so believable and authentic and they just cast it so well. At the end of production, you know, I'm still writing these tracks that are, you know, I sort of graduated from just like doing this imaginary first episode, and then I'm doing, as they're starting to edit, Tony and Dan are contacting me saying, you know, we're looking at the first assemblies and we think we need music that sounds like this. Mm-hmm. We think we need something, a couple of tracks that are moody.
Mm-hmm.
We think we need a couple of tracks that are kind of scary. Here, like, listen to this track from this other show.
Mm-hmm.
We need a few like this. We need a few like that. So now I'm writing a bunch of sort of general tracks for them, all with the show sort of sight unseen.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time I got the assembly of the first and second and third episodes,
mm-hmm.
My music was in there already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Had been placed there, by the editors.
Yeah.
I had set up a Dropbox,
mm-hmm.
folder,
mm-hmm.
That they all had access to. And so whenever I would, finish a cue, it would go right up on Dropbox.
Mm-hmm.
So in this Dropbox folder was essentially kind of a kind of mini library music that they could just pull in,
mm-hmm.
and drop, you know, sort of on as temp music.
Yeah.
It's sort of fallen. I don't know. He sort of fell into this rhythm of where they would send me the, you know, each episode, the editing process for each episode, the cuts, there are several different cuts that they have to sort of cycle through.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, everyone involved in the making of the show has to basically sign off on it.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll have, what's called the director's cut,
mm-hmm.
and then the producer's cut.
Mm-hmm.
So the producer has to look at it and give them interrupts. Then that's the producer's cut.
Mm-hmm.
Then the network, which is CBS,
mm-hmm.
they send it to CBS. CBS has their notes.
Yeah.
They refine it some more.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, they get to, what is considered the fine cut. That is very, very close to the final version.
Yeah.
Throughout all this, I'm going through it, and I'm sort of hearing what they used where.
Mm-hmm.
Making my own decisions, sort of based on, what I think works and what doesn't. And, actually, the editors are super talented as well. And they made some really good choices.
Yeah.
Choices that I hadn't even thought of.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the times I was just sort of saying, oh yeah, this works.
Mm-hmm.
This track music, works here on this scene. And then it was a matter of, refining,
mm-hmm.
refining the music so that it really works to picture.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the cuts that the editors made, they were treating it like temp music. So the cuts were rough.
Mm-hmm.
There was some stuff that was, just not very musical.
Mm-hmm.
Sounded like, kind of a jump in the music.
Yeah.
All that stuff had to be fixed.
Yeah, smoothed over, and transitions.
And worked. So transitions had to be written, changes needed to be made in orchestration.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes keys needed to be changed,
mm-hmm.
so that if one key moved into another, it was in the same key, or at least a kind of complementary key.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
That's how this music got made, basically.
Nice.
That's the sort of
the rough
version of it.
Yeah.
The rough, the general version of it.
Yeah, yeah. It was cool seeing that stuff come in and like getting to know your process a little bit of watching through it saying, yeah, that the editor has made like a really, this is a great choice that they made that I wouldn't have thought of, or I don't like this choice. Let me write something new for this scene.
Right. Right. Yeah. The editors were terrific. I wish I had like, I mean, I feel as though the team that we had working on the show was just really great, even though like there were all these moving parts and we didn't even really interact with each other very much.
Mm-hmm.
But there were definitely a few moments where these editors, not only did they choose like the right music cue,
mm-hmm.
but they chose the right moment.
Yeah.
So if I was writing with a, you know, there were a couple of subsequent episodes where, you know, Tony would call me and say, like, we really need something special for the last scene of episode such and such,
mm-hmm.
for example. So I'd read through that last few scenes of mm-hmm. that episode, and I would write something sort of based on
mm-hmm.
what I think the action is going to be.
Yeah.
And the editors kind of got it. They understood what I was doing, you know?
Nice.
So even if they had to make a bunch of cuts, like, around it, they knew that that moment was there and they knew to place it.
Yeah.
You know, there.
Yeah.
In the right spot. And then when I got it back, I would, like, you know, take everything that came before it and afterward and just sort of smooth all that over so that it turned into something, you know, much more cohesive.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Nice. So how long was your process again? What, like once you really started to get, oh, the cat's here.
you can probably hear me.
It's possible. Yeah. How long was your process again? How many weeks? Like once you were getting, like some sort of a cut.
I started getting the cuts in March,
mm-hmm.
and the last episode wrapped on June 8th.
Okay, yeah, I remember during the earlier days. Yeah, you're gonna hear the cat again this episode, guys. come here. There was some talk about you potentially having to move to LA for like 12 weeks.
The 12 week, it was a 12 week post.
Mm-hmm.
So 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the original plan was I think the filming was, you know, January and February,
mm-hmm.
between January and February, and then really, you know, March, April, and May.
Mm-hmm.
We were supposed to get it done by the end of May.
Mm-hmm.
That got pushed back by 1 week,
mm-hmm.
due to a couple of scheduling issues that mm-hmm. had nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
When I was speaking to the couple of the, you know, producers,
mm-hmm.
You know, trying to get the job, they were, the first thing that one guy asked me was, you know, can you do this here in LA?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yes. And I mean, I was thinking to myself, I don't know how the hell I'm going to move to LA, but I'm not going to say, no, I can't do that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Just say yes, and then you'll figure it out.
You know, yeah. Yeah, we were already, like, going, okay, so I'll stay here with the cat. And
right. you know, it turned into, you know, 12 weeks turned into, like, 6 weeks. I said, do you need me to come out? They said, then they were saying, well, maybe you only need to be here for the second half of post.
Mm-hmm.
I said, okay. Then I'm working on the thing,
mm-hmm.
here from, you know, here in New York, and basically kind of doing it the same way I'd basically done all these other much smaller projects with Tony and Dan.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the music has always been done remotely.
Mm-hmm.
And any changes, you know, that, you know, any notes would be over the phone, mm-hmm. or via email.
Mm-hmm.
And we just kept doing it that way.
Yeah.
And I think once it became clear to the producers and the showrunner that actually it's getting done,
mm-hmm.
the process is running, you know, relatively smoothly.
Yeah.
And then it the thinking changed to, like, when do we get him out here? To, do we need him out here at all, given that the music is happening,
mm-hmm.
we're liking what we're getting, why futz with that?
Yeah.
You know, it would mean a lot of logistics would have to be mm-hmm. worked out.
Yeah.
And given the schedule, it probably just at that point didn't seem like it made much sense. It probably would have been a mistake.
Yeah. As things went on, I remember the discussion that, like, you would be disrupted by several days to pack and travel and unpack and set up, and now you're several days behind schedule.
Well, there's the traveling thing. There's, like, the you know, the finding a place to stay, finding a place to work.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully that would have been one place, but I mean, you know.
You never know.
You never know. Then there's just the whole, you know, rigmarole of being involved in, you know, like being there for every mix session.
Mm-hmm.
That's a day.
Yeah, and that's a day you're not writing.
Right. That's a day I'm not writing. Now, obviously, I don't really know what it would have been like. I mean, I may have only been there for a couple of hours just mm-hmm. to check on it.
Yeah.
I mean, these are things that I expect I'll learn, you know,
in subsequent in the next projects. Project, yeah.
You know, actually, this is like a good opportunity to sort of pivot to, you know, getting technical about it.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
Talking about, like, you know, what I kind of discovered while I was doing this.
Yeah. Totally.
So why don't you ask me a couple of things so that I can, like,
yeah, I can do that. I'm the host. So I know that one big thing that you, really figured out in a big way throughout the project was, workflow. How going from yes. getting from, point A to point Z in a way that's consistent and not just right. flailing.
Yeah. So the first thing is deciding on the palette that you're using,
mm-hmm.
kind of early,
mm-hmm.
in, you know, as early as you can.
Yeah.
I mean, by the time I would say by the end of February,
mm-hmm.
I was very much inhabiting a certain world,
mm-hmm.
Certain sonic world,
yeah.
Where I was using certain instruments,
mm-hmm.
To do certain things,
yeah.
Different patterns and different themes had already been, like, developed. So,
mm-hmm.
While I'm doing that, so with each session, as I build my sessions, this was all mostly done digitally. So I would save every. Instrument track as a user track,
mm-hmm.
That I would be able to sort of kind of refer to.
Yeah.
And I had started to organize them by instrument groups.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, percussion and various percussive elements went in one folder.
Mm-hmm.
And then guitars and basses and all that
mm-hmm.
went into another folder, and keys went into a third, and tuned percussion and strings, so that if I'm building a new cue from scratch, I have these things that I can just call up.
Yeah.
stuff that I had already used. So yeah. I'm automatically, you know, using the same kind of palette. And obviously, you know, with each session that I would create, I'd obviously create a different session for each cue.
Mm-hmm.
I would have to do some modification.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, you know, pretty minimal.
Yeah.
That is actually the one thing that I will do differently next time.
Yeah.
Is that I didn't have a full template built.
Okay.
I had my instruments
mm-hmm.
sort of organized.
Mm-hmm.
But when I'm writing a new cue, I was pulling up a blank session
mm-hmm.
and sort of pulling in instruments as I needed them.
Yeah. No, what software? You're building this in what software though?
So I use Logic 10,
mm-hmm.
which is Apple's DAW. It's a competitor to other DAWs like Pro Tools.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of composers use Cubase.
Mm-hmm.
I've used Logic for about 10 years,
mm-hmm.
and I'm very used to it.
Yeah.
I'm fast with it.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, it makes no sense for me to try to change it.
Yeah.
And I like it. I think it's easy to use. It's easy to compose it.
Yeah.
Using that software.
Yeah.
It's easy to get the kind of stuff that I want.
Yeah.
I'm using Logic primarily.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I'm doing, you know, sort of on the business end of it is, not only am I like saving each patch
mm-hmm.
or each instrument sound,
mm-hmm.
All the sessions in my cues are going into a single folder.
Mm-hmm.
So I have this folder on my computer called American Vandal Season 1.
Mm-hmm.
And within that folder is a bunch of other folders, each containing its own session.
Yeah.
And they're titled kind of bullshit titles, like, sparse
mm-hmm.
version 1.
Yeah.
Sparse version 2, things like that.
Yeah.
Scary version 1 or scary version 2, et cetera. Mm-hmm. and they're just for me.
Yeah.
You know. Next time I'll do better titles, I think.
You know, whatever.
Titles should be more specific. I had found a couple of times where it's actually hard to keep track.
Oh yeah, I can imagine after a while.
If you're making six versions that are like sparse,
mm-hmm.
quote unquote,
mm-hmm.
It's better to have individual titles.
Yeah.
For each one.
Yeah.
So that you're not saying, was that version 4 or version 6?
Yeah.
I can't really remember.
Yeah, yeah.
Let me go back and you lose a lot of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, it's easy to lose time.
So once I would get the episodes, the first thing I would do is I'd pull the episode into a Logic session,
mm-hmm.
and I would watch and listen,
mm-hmm.
and I made sure that the versions that the editors were sending me were panned versions.
Mm.
And by that I mean the dialogue and sound effects
mm-hmm.
are on the left channel
mm-hmm.
and the music is on the right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This way I can separate them and mute one or the other.
Yeah.
And work with that. So if I really wanted to like kind of hear what music they were doing, I'd be able to mute the dialogue
mm-hmm.
and the sound effects.
Yeah.
And just hear the music. And vice versa.
Yeah, yeah.
So when I'm composing the actual music for the episode, I didn't have the tent music playing
mm-hmm.
at the same time.
Yeah, you don't want it like all jumbled.
Right. So that's very important
yeah.
to have that. You know, you need to get that from the editors.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be either panned or they can send you the picture with two audio stripes.
Yeah.
Or as many audio stripes as they want to send you.
Mm-hmm.
As long as the music is separate from the other elements, that's really the most important thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So once I would watch and listen through, I would actually do my own sort of auditioning of tracks mm-hmm. that I had already written. I would do this to sort of save time.
Yeah.
It's, you know, obviously I wanted to compose as much unique music as I can, but the fact is I had already composed a lot of music.
Yeah.
And so I was finding that, like, it was not getting too repetitive.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain amount of, you know, kind of theme repetition over the course of 8 episodes that you want.
Yeah.
You want some things to start being recognizable to people. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, totally.
You know, some melodies or some ostinatos or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But all in all, I was getting the sense that it was not sounding like 2 or 3 cues that just kind of ran over and over.
Yeah.
So I would start auditioning my own cues, like whether they were the same cues that were used in the temp
mm-hmm.
or different ones. I would pull the bounced stereo version
mm-hmm.
of the cue that I wanted into mm-hmm. this kind of auditioning session
mm-hmm.
and importing the tempo of the file.
Mm-hmm.
Logic has this great feature where if you bounce a wave, there's metadata that it creates
mm-hmm.
based on the session that is bouncing. So if your session is running at like 120 BPM
mm-hmm.
and you take that wave file that you've bounced and you import it into another session, you can also import from the metadata of the wave the BPM
mm-hmm.
of the track.
Yeah.
So using that, I was able to kind of easily chop the tracks up down to the beat.
Yeah.
If I wanted to.
Yeah.
And kind of create kind of temporary transitions. So mm-hmm. if I wanted to loop something, I was able to do that,
nice.
Et cetera. So I was able to create my own kind of rough edit. It's a little bit finer than what the editors were able to do because they were, you know, the stuff that I was doing was down to the beat and
yeah.
still kind of musical. The edits were still rough.
Yeah.
From there, I would take that kind of chopped up audio and I would copy the original session that I had written the original cue in
mm-hmm.
into the episode folder. So mm-hmm. I'd create episode folders for each episode.
Yeah.
8 folders in all. And so let's say I was working on episode 1 and I had there was a scene that I was doing. I know I'm using this original track for this scene.
Mm-hmm.
I would take that session, that original session, I'd copy it into the episode 1
mm-hmm.
folder and import the chopped up wave that I had done mm-hmm. in the audition session.
Yeah. So
I'd import that into this new session folder. And I would basically kind of mirror the edits that I made in the original WAV file
mm-hmm.
in the kind of multi-track session.
Yeah.
And with that, I have the sort of freedom to, you know, make the edits even more kind of musical.
Yeah.
And smoother and play with the orchestration if I want to.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe get a new idea and add a counter melody.
Yeah.
Or drop the rhythm out.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, there are so many, obviously there's so many different options that you can do.
Yeah.
When you're not just playing with a, you know, a two-track, left and right.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, once I had gotten through an episode of doing that, that would basically take me about a week.
Okay.
All totals,
mm-hmm.
I would say. But from, you know, auditioning the track to, I would say, the audition process. I call it the audition process.
Yeah.
Of, like, deciding what kind of music I want where.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that that would take probably 2 to 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And these are, like, full days.
Yeah.
Of work, you know. And then there's the actual editing,
mm-hmm.
of the music, the chopping it up and then getting it into the original, or copying the original session and getting it all edited.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm manipulating a cat right now.
I see him. So that would take about four days or so.
Yeah.
And then of course, you know, I would send it back to LA.
Mm-hmm.
I would get their notes. I would have to probably go back.
Yeah.
And make further changes.
Yeah.
You know, the good thing is that because I have such a good rapport with the creators of the show, I was mostly hitting the mark.
Yeah.
The first time. And, you know, the changes that they made, I mean, it was rare where they would basically say to me, like, this cue really just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
You need to either go back to what we had in the temp or you need to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
That happened a few times, but it didn't happen that much.
Yeah, yeah, which is good.
Which is very good. Yeah, I mean, that's how each episode really got.
Yeah.
Got finished.
Yeah.
At least from a compositional standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Did you come up across any, like, pitfalls along the way? Anything that like, snagged you that you felt like you had to figure out?
Well, nothing major. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of times there would be a situation where I would get back, I'd get a new cut of an episode, and it would turn out that, like, a few frames had been shaved off of one scene.
Mm.
And so if I've got music running through that, you know, the music would need to be adjusted.
Yeah.
And then every subsequent cue, even if every other scene is the same,
mm-hmm.
all those cues would have to be moved.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
So that they line up correctly.
Mm.
You know, that's something I noticed. I don't think I would call it a pitfall. It's just sort of comes with the territory,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah,
this is the way it works.
Yeah.
You know? When we were gearing up to actually sort of put these episodes in the can,
mm-hmm.
I was put in touch with the re-record mix engineer.
Mm-hmm.
He was a great guy. His name is John Chamberlain. It was from him that I discovered that they actually want not just the stereo mixes,
mm-hmm.
but they actually want stems,
mm-hmm.
which are, it's sort of in between a stereo and a multi-track. Stems are like, kind of grouped tracks.
Yeah.
So percussion,
mm-hmm.
and strings.
Yeah.
And et cetera. It's keys,
mm-hmm.
guitar. And I also found out that the sort of the specs are that they, most of the post-mixing houses, at least in Los Angeles, use Pro Tools, and they want Pro Tools sessions.
Yeah.
Well, I don't use Pro Tools. So what I had to do was buy a subscription. Pro Tools now has a, you know, you don't have to buy it full out. You can buy a monthly subscription.
Yeah.
That's about $30 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to download the software and use it. As long as you pay your subscription every month, you can use it as much as you want. It's like Adobe now.
Yeah, yeah. Adobe
has that too. And so I had to quickly learn a couple of Pro Tools things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that.
And so the first couple of things I had to do when I was like breaking down, you know, preparing an episode for delivery was going into each queue. And I would have like an average of 15 to 18 queues per episode.
Yeah.
Some more, some less. But each queue had to be stemmed out.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to go into each session and group the tracks so that they would all bounce together.
Yeah.
So that when I soloed the group, everything would bounce. So that process was about 1 to 2 day process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From there, I would have to prep kind of a layup session where the stereo versions of the cues are there.
Mm-hmm.
And underneath it, the stems are there as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, we're talking about 18 cues.
Mm-hmm.
So over the timeline of about 30 minutes, I have the stereo and the stems for cue number one, and then cue number two and number three.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to create a stem template.
Mm.
Let's say that you have two musical cues, but they sort of fade into each other.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, there's a little kind of transition from one to the other.
Yeah.
It's not a break.
Mm-hmm.
So you have like the tail of one note and then the downbeat of the next cue comes in before the tail of the previous cue had like kind of run out.
Yeah, yeah.
You need to have two separate audio tracks.
Mm-hmm.
For one for the first cue and one for the second cue.
Okay.
That means you have to double up almost every track for your stems.
Oh, yeah.
So if you have one percussion track, now you need two percussion tracks.
Yeah, one for each cue.
One for each cue. Now, you really only need two tracks because if the second cue goes into the third cue, you can just go back and use the first track.
Yeah.
For the third cue.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a zigzag thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So that's what I discovered I had to do.
Yeah.
And so I made this template. This was where I really made the template. I discovered, I should have made session template. Well, but I made this template where everything was really clearly labeled.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would make that template in Logic, make sure that the sample rate was all correct.
Mm-hmm.
I would export that session as what's called an AAF. It's a way of transferring a session from one platform to another.
Okay.
So let's say you have like a bunch of, it really only works with audio files, but like if you have a session that's like all audio and in Logic, but you want to move it over to Pro Tools, you have to convert it to either an OMF or an AAF.
Mm-hmm.
And Logic only does AAFs for some reason.
Okay.
So once I had done that, I would open it up in Pro Tools, make sure that it still works.
Yeah.
You know? So that means importing the video into Pro Tools, making sure that everything still lines up.
Mm-hmm.
And then sending that off to the post house.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all remotely, so it's all through the internet.
Yeah.
You know? The post houses I use had their own clients that would, they would, you know, they gave me a login.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a username and a password, and I was able to just drag the folder
mm-hmm.
Into the browser, watch it.
Yeah.
Watch it upload.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, they would download it, and the most time it would be fine.
Yeah, nice. I remember that was a process that you hadn't really had to deal with before, and so like it was great that to have the engineer like walk you through that.
Well, John was great. He let me know exactly what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
About 2 weeks before.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave me enough time to sort of make sure that all my ducks were in a row.
Yeah, yeah, you could like play around with it a bit and learn.
Yeah.
Learn in time.
Right. Right. I mean, I had a couple of dry runs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the day, which didn't work.
Yeah.
So there were a couple of things that I realized I had to do for it to actually work.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was a little nerve wracking.
Yeah.
But it all worked out. So,
yeah. Nice. Yeah. Yeah, it seems like one of the biggest things that you kind of came to throughout this is like that consistency is key.
Consistency is very key. Organization is key.
Mm-hmm.
Organization is absolutely key.
Mm-hmm.
Having a schedule,
mm-hmm.
Where you actually have to, you really need to plan your moves.
Yeah.
So when you're juggling multiple episodes like this, and it's only me, mm-hmm. like I didn't have, there weren't other composers on this thing.
Yeah.
And the schedule is so tight. So we're working on several different episodes basically at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So each day really needed to be planned. So I created a schedule for myself where I would say, okay, what are the due dates for every episode?
Mm-hmm.
Then you budget your time. Okay, well, how long do you think it's going to take for the auditioning process?
Mm-hmm.
What about the composing? Okay, mm-hmm. what about the prep, the delivery prep?
Yeah.
And so once all of that stuff was budgeted out, I would put it in my calendar. Okay, for example, 6 hours today on episode 2,
mm-hmm.
composing.
Yeah.
3 hours on episode 1 for delivery prep.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe 2 hours on episode 3 for auditioning.
Yeah.
So on any given day, there was like multiple things that I had to be doing.
Yeah.
And sometimes, I actually found myself ahead of schedule a lot once I had gotten that,
mm-hmm.
Schedule down.
Yeah.
I found myself, I actually had more time than I thought.
Nice.
I was very, liberal with how much time I thought I needed.
Yeah.
In other words, liberal meaning like,
you gave yourself way more time than you actually.
I budgeted way more time than I actually think I needed.
Yeah, which is I think always really smart.
Well, I mean, when you don't really know when this is the first time you're doing this,
mm-hmm.
it's always better to like be safe.
Yeah.
Than fuck it up and never work again.
Yeah, yeah, whatever. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, give yourself more time than you think you need so that you can be ahead of schedule, so that when you need more time, you have it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's that was the process pretty much.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty pretty cool to watch that from the sidelines, the whole thing. So we're just about at the hour mark here. So is there any last little bit of, for somebody who might be thinking about doing this, or, any other little things that you learned along the way that you think is valuable?
So I think that for someone who's doing this, who wants to do this kind of work,
mm-hmm.
and is just starting out, the biggest advice, at least in terms of getting your foot in the door,
mm-hmm.
is knowing people is important.
Yeah.
Building creative relationships with your sort of director, producer counterparts is very mm-hmm. important.
Yeah.
So, you know, don't be afraid to find some students,
mm-hmm.
Some young people who, you know, you're willing to do some, frankly, free work for.
Mm-hmm.
They have to be, you know, you have to really believe in them. They have to be really good.
Yeah.
You have to think that they're going to go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I did. You know, but this whole stupid business is about creating these relationships.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
People say it's who you know kind of derisively, but people want to work with people that they're comfortable with.
Yeah.
And that they have a rapport with.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, I've always worked really well with these guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We understand each other.
Yeah.
And then as far as the technical stuff, the stuff that I said before, just organization is so, so important.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have an assistant or an intern that's going to handle this stuff,
mm-hmm.
you really need to be on the ball.
Yeah.
As far as, organization goes.
Yeah.
Otherwise you're just going to be, it's going to be a mess.
Yeah.
Be and I feel like in this project, I was like sort of 60% there. And next time I'm going to be even further along.
Yeah.
You know, hopefully I'll be 70 or 80% there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, organization is not my natural sort of state, but I'm getting there. I'm getting better at it. At least I've sort of learned to appreciate how important it really is.
Yeah.
You know, that's like one of the big things, the big sort of learning experiences for me on this is that actually, no, it's actually good to be organized.
Yeah. Yeah. We have the idea of artists as disorganized and organization is the antithesis of creating good art. It's like, actually,
that is so wrong.
Yeah, it's really helpful to be organized.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for being here this week. And,
oh, thank you for having me again.
Yeah. And people can find the show American Vandal on Netflix. And
we were just picked up for a second season,
which is awesome.
So we'll be doing it all over again next year.
Nice.
So watch season one, and if you're listening to this in 2018, probably in the later half of the year,
mm-hmm.
Watch both season one and season two.
Yeah, watch season one again if you've already seen
it. Right.
Awesome. So yeah, thank you so much.
You can find me at Darian Sheldon.
Oh yes, yes, you have a brand new website made by someone, with all sorts of new video and stuff, which is fun.
Yeah, he's not that good, but he did it for free. So
yeah, okay. I know. He's kind of a yeah.
The joke is that Dennis did the website.
And also that he's bad. It's funny because it's true.
No, I love my website.
Yeah, I'm very happy with it.
I think it's great.
Yeah, got a lot of cool stuff up there.
Yeah.
So yeah, everybody, thank you.
And you can follow me on Twitter.
Yes, Twitter. I'll make sure all those links are up in the show notes and everything. And yeah, thank you all for listening, and I will talk to you next time.